Welcome to All Politics is Local in Massachusetts on New England's News and Talk Radio, 830 WCRN. To join the conversation, call 508-871-7000. Now, here's your hosts, John Featherston and Terry Hendricks.
From the Broadcast Center of WCRN 830, you're listening to All Politics is Local on the last Sunday of 2015. Good morning. I'm John Featherston, that distinguished man right there. That's Terry Hendricks. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, John. Good morning, New England. Here we are, last Sunday of the year. Not terrible weather out, a little cool and rainy, but hey, it's not snowing, although there's a threat, I guess, this coming Tuesday. But it's been like a Christmas. I grew up in southern Oklahoma, where we may have snow any time during the winter, but not every winter. So I've kind of enjoyed this nice weather. I was actually Christmas Eve down at my daughter's down in Hull, right by the beach. So that was nice down there. And but hey, today is the second day of Kwanzaa.
There you go. Happy Kwanzaa, everybody.
Which was a holiday created to celebrate African heritage. By our African-American friends. It was created in, I think, 1996. So it's a nice holiday, seven-day holiday that celebrates African culture and heritage and food and drink.
But, happy Kwanzaa, everybody out there. The new year is ending quickly. It'll be over just this week. So, like I said, the last Sunday of 2015. Kind of recapping the year that was in 2015 politically. I mean, what are your thoughts, Terry?
Well, politically, we got rid of the old regime of Patrick and company, and brought in a new guy there, Charlie Baker, and I think based on the polls, he's doing a superlative job. But he certainly had his hands full. He started the year off in I think January 8th, and then it started snowing, and the train stopped running, and there was a huge budget shortfall, and then the DCF. Had issues, and so we're not sure what his real agenda was, but it's right now he's still trying to drain the swamp.
Well, Charlie Baker is the T going forward. Charlie Baker's legacy will be defined by the T, good or bad. I think it's going to be a huge effort. It'll be interesting this week to see, with the snow, even though we're only going to get a couple inches of snow. It's amazing that, people are freaking out about a couple inches of snow. We do still live in New England, people. It does snow here a lot. Going to be interesting to see what happens. I'm predicting a T call in sick type of, you got the white flu coming up this weekend because, the Carmen Union's still not happy with Governor Baker. And kudos to Governor Baker for, shaking it up a little bit. Mike Dukakis is weighing in telling, Charlie Baker how to run the T. I find that to be somewhat comical.
Well, doesn't former Governor Dukakis take the T routinely?
I thought he drove a tank.
With a leather helmet or whatever it was. That's the thing. Talk about little things that sink an election. That was it. And then was it Willie Horton was the other thing that came to?
Absolutely. Willie Horton, yeah. But, Mike Dukakis weighing in and telling Charlie Baker how to run the T. I just find that to be comical at best. But
well, Charlie's a guy who listens, and he takes good advice. So I'm not sure what former Governor Dukakis was telling him, but – you know what? Some of it might be good advice in deference to our former governor. And I'm sure Charlie listened to him, and we'll take whatever advice he thinks is appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it will be interesting to see how the first major snowstorm, which I don't think is going to be this week, is taken into effect. 2015, 151 new laws were enacted in the state of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
You had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of laws, but 43 of them were sick leave bank transfers. There's a program for a state worker can transfer some of his or her sick time to another worker that is in need of more time because of maybe a health issue or a family health issue or whatever. But it takes an act of the legislature to transfer this time from one employee to another. So do you think that's a little overkill in regulation or what?
It must be Massachusetts.
And then another dozen of them were for alcohol licenses in cities and towns. So, when you really get down to it, there were just under 100 laws enacted. And I guess if you looked at them, you know, how many of them are kind of routine stuff? You know, I remember when I was in the Water and Sewer Commission, we had to have an act of the legislature to protect the watershed around our reservoir there in Ashland and Hopkinton. And that took an act of the legislature.
Right.
So you see things that you wonder if you just peel back the onion, how many of them were really key pieces of legislation that make a difference?
A lot of them are just, like you said, procedural.
Housekeeping.
Yeah, just, you know, housekeeping, you know, moving money around from one account, you know, making sure the money doesn't sunset, which is what a lot of what these sick banks are, making sure that money doesn't go away. You know, you got to keep the money flowing. But so overall, not an overly productive year, and with cutting legislation or anything. There was a lot of stuff left, you know, that kind of died with the House and the Senate.
Well, it's not dead because the legislative session is 2 years.
Right.
So we're in the middle of that, so they've got a whole year to go to do nothing.
But the open meeting law piece, they want to die on the vine. They don't want to touch it. It's the third rail of politics. You know, you and I have railed about it on this show and on our television show for years, that the same rules for the legislature should be the same rules that are governed by the cities and towns.
Well, it looks like what they're going to pass, if they do pass any, will be, you know, the legislature, the governor, and I think the judicial are basically exempt from open law.
Open meeting
open
law.
Records law.
Right.
So, you know, there was a recent survey done, and basically Massachusetts failed. The Northeastern Journalism class, in conjunction with the Globe and WCVB-TV, did a little test out there, and they went to the 351 cities and towns of Massachusetts, and they went in there to ask them, you know, for two kinds of records. You know, one is, what is your payroll? In other words, what does everybody in town make? And secondly is, another one was around police records, around police abuse, that kind of a thing.
Police engagement, how they engage the public. Yeah.
Right. And so 58% of the 351 municipalities failed. And, you know, there is a law that says they have to respond within 10 days. I think a bunch of them got around 240 days. A bunch of them said it's none of your business, especially around the public payroll. And it is our business. And, you know, so it's what are they hiding?
Yeah, so watch for that tonight on Channel 5 WCVB at 11 o'clock news. I think it'll be a very interesting promo. We're going to take a quick break. Coming up at the 10:30 hour, I want a promo. We've got Raheel Raza, a Canadian Muslim, coming on. It's going to be a very controversial topic, so stay tuned for that. You're tuned to All Politics is Local on WCRN 830. We'll be back after the break.
On the day I was born, the nurses all gathered round. They gazed in wide wonder at the joy they had found.
You're listening to All Politics is Local in Massachusetts on New England's News and Talk Radio, 830 WCRN. Once again, here's your hosts, John Featherston and Terry Hendricks.
Good Sunday morning. You're tuned to All Politics is Local on WCRN 830. To join the conversation, work the phones 508-871-7000. That's 508-871-7000. Or follow us on the web at allpoliticsma.com. Allpoliticsislocalma.com. That's Terry Hendricks. Good morning. I'm John Featherston on the last Sunday morning of 2015. We're talking about local politics and the debt ceiling in Massachusetts, Terry.
Well, yeah, we're talking about the debt ceiling. It's time to either figure out what they want to do about it. It's a quick 20. The current debt ceiling is $21.735 billion. Now, what that translates to is about $3,500 for every man, woman, and child in Massachusetts. No small number. So if you think about, you know, look at your young child. Doesn't matter if you're a child is an infant or, 25 years old, they owe the state $3,500 in just debt alone.
How sustainable is that going forward, do you think? I mean,
well, that's just it. They're going to have to do one of two things. They're either going to have to raise the cap, which may have implications on bond rating, maybe not, or do a little, typical political juggling, whereas that's really the general obligation. So they could have some special versus a general obligation debt. So they can have some other debt that, say, might be funded by a project that would be a little bit different than a general obligation. So there's some things they can do, but, you know, they'll probably act just like our federal government. They'll do it at the 11th and a half hour or maybe even later.
Well, I mean, we've talked about it for years. You know, you've got the problems that the cities and towns are going to have because they have to fund their own retirement packages, and that's coming up very, very soon, and they've been kicking that can down the road. The T has been identified, and it came out this past week. You know, you're going to need $1 billion, with a B, $1 billion worth of upgrades. His biggest fan, and we all know I'm a card-carrying member of the Charlie Baker fan club here, is great of a fiscal agent and a manager that he is. You need revenue. And revenue, you have to revenue your way out of this problem. That being said, we talked a little bit about population growth in the state. Massachusetts is growing a little bit. I think you had it at, what, 3.6%?
Yeah, between 2010 and 2015, Massachusetts grew 3.8% its population. So we don't know how many of those came from foreign soil, but...
Probably a majority.
But who knows? I mean, you know, Massachusetts has a pretty liberal...
counting mechanism?
You know, EBT, welfare, help everybody thing, which is, I think, mixed. Some good, some bad. But, you know, the Northeast overall only grew 1.7%. So, you know, well, we're not growing as fast as the South and the West, which were growing around 5.8%, 5.7% respectively.
But that being said, I mean, to fix some of these problems, you're going to have to grow revenue. I mean, Massachusetts did a great job during the internet boom of bringing tech companies to the area. In Metro West, in our backyard, you've got the biotech companies that have come in. You're going to need to keep that growth going. Is that going to be sustainable? I mean, it's expensive to do business in Massachusetts. Bad, or indifferent, that's the reality.
Well, it is. And, you know, if you look at some of the things that Charlie Baker is trying to do, he's trying to reduce the cost of power or electricity, energy. One of it is to buy power from Canadian hydro dams.
Yep.
He's doing some things to basically cut at it in a different way. He's looking to simplify regulations in Massachusetts to make it easier for both, you know, the citizens and business to do business with the state. But they have a serious issue coming up here in the new budget year. The Mass Taxpayers Foundation has projected roughly $1 billion shortfall. Now, that's on top of the $1 billion of revenue growth over the
over
years. So it's not like...
And the growth has been good.
Yeah, but, you know, the real issue is you've got much higher health cost, health care cost, and pension cost. Pension cost for every city and town in the state, and not just in Massachusetts, but really across the country.
Across the country, huh?
You know, the pension, health and pension costs are just becoming phenomenal. Almost all of them are underfunded by huge amounts. And at some point, it's going to tilt the wagon in a bad way.
You will see multiple cities and towns declare bankruptcy in the next 4 to 5 years.
And what's going to happen is all these folks, especially in municipal, who have negotiated pretty good contracts and are making a pretty good money. If you remember, you know, a few years ago when you and I came to Massachusetts, you know, city and state workers made okay money, but they had really good benefits. Well, now they make pretty good money and they have great benefits.
And still have a great retirement package.
Yes, they do. And I don't begrudge that to them, but there
Not
is a
all.
Serious issue of affordability and longer term because these pension plans, well, one of the things that's happened on a lot of pension plans, one of the key assumptions for a long time is they'd assume an 8% return on their pension funds. Well, the reality has been more like, you know, 3 to 4% in these last few years of basically very little inflation. Interest rates, you know, the Fed rates have been close to zero. They raised them a little bit here a few days ago. But, you know, the market kind of yawned, and in fact, the mortgage rate actually went down a little bit to below 4%. So.
Well, you know, as we come to the end of the year, most people in the listening audience, you're going to look to the end of the year in their jobs and their career. Hopefully, they'll get a review of their performance in the last year. and hopefully, you know, a pay raise going into 2016. Now, the interesting thing when you look at cities and towns with Proposition 2.5, you raise your revenue by 2.5, but look at your teachers' contracts. Look at your public safety contracts. Those are always negotiated higher than 2.5%. And then you throw in, you know, nobody really knows what the real cost of Obamacare is going to be yet. That's still the haunting figure out there. Nobody knows. And anybody who tells you they know, they're lying to you. Nobody knows. So you're going to see cities and towns, their budgets are going to increase by 4% and 5%, and they're going to wake up in March and go, hey, what happened? And, you know, shame on most of those cities and towns. But you and I have seen it. We've seen it on the local level for years.
Oh, exactly. I mean, about the most you can raise your levy in a town in Massachusetts is 3%. 2.5% in Prop 2.5.
You can tweak your local receipts
for growth.
And make it 3.25, yeah.
3.25 is really a bit of a stretch, mm-hmm. I think. You know, it's usually around 3. But, you know, when you negotiate with the teachers and they get 4%, and then you have higher medical and pension costs on top of that, you know, how does that formula work?
It doesn't, and that's the problem, and that's, you know, you talk about an override, and an override sounds good in theory, and a lot of times, oh, it's, you know, we'll just pass an override. Overrides don't go away. They're sustainable, and they're figured into the budget, and a lot of times they're an emotional figure into the budget, and they're not thought out over a 50-year plan. Now, if you figured them out over a 50-year plan, not just a 4-year plan or so forth, there might be some credibility to them, but a lot of times they're not thought out in that way.
Well, you know, a lot of times people say, well, we need a new school, we need a new this, you know, in other words, a capital project. Well, the way to do a capital project is really not an override, but a debt exclusion.
Right.
And that's the way to do those specific projects. But an override, your levy goes up forever by whatever that amount is. You know, I know in our town, a Prop 2.5 override has never passed, although it looked like there's one coming for about $2.5 million, it'll be on the ballot in the spring.
Well, they're still in the negotiating phases because, you know, as I call it with air quotes, they're still in the marketing phase of trying to make it sellable to the public, which, you know, hey, if you're out there and you want to join the conversation, talk about your local town and what some of the issues are with, you know, Prop 2.5 and, you know, structural overrides, join us at 508-871-7000. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to be joined by Rahil Raza, who is a Muslim-Canadian journalist whose book is called Their Jihad Is Not My Jihad. So that's going to be an interesting conversation. She's going to join us at 10:30. But getting back to the structural override of the state, Charlie Baker made the budget work last year. Kudos to him. He is going to have some challenges, you know, coming up in 2016.
Well, you know, the challenge is going to be one. There's a billion-dollar budget shortfall. You know, everybody's wish list is, of course, going to be thrown into the bucket there. And they need to start putting money into the stabilization fund.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. And on top of that, there are a number of one-time occurrences that this past year had, and they're not going to have those. Now, are they going to have other one-time events that may help? Yeah. You know, could they sell some more of the state's real estate and bring in some money? Yeah, there's a lot of stuff sitting around that I think they could sell. And if you look at, you know, I read something recently that the commercial real estate in Massachusetts is becoming not scarce, but not as plentiful as it once was. So I think there might be some opportunity to sell some of these state land and buildings. And but again, you know, that's a one-time. That's a Band-Aid.
Right, that's just a Band-Aid.
But there's just a structural issue there. And, you know, our taxes are high enough in Massachusetts, quite honestly. But there's a spending problem.
Oh, absolutely.
And Charlie recognizes there's a spending problem. There's a spending problem at the T. You know,
$350,000 a year for a maintenance worker?
I tell you, and it's, you know, overtime. The guy had 2,600 hours of overtime.
Now, that means he worked 50 hours a week of overtime, which means he worked 90 hours a week. Now, maybe he put in the hours, but you can't convince me he worked, and the key word is worked, 90 hours a week.
God bless the guy, because he basically, you know, the average work year is 2,200 hours.
Right.
So this guy basically put in over 2 years in 1 year.
But do you believe that?
No.
Just from a physical standpoint, not from an integrity standpoint, not from, you know, was he milking the clock or anything, just physically could he do that? We'll pick up that conversation later. You're tuned to All Politics is Local on WCRN 830. Like I said, we're going to be joined by Raheel Raza at the bottom of the hour. Now we're going to take a break for CBS News. You're listening to All Politics is Local on WCRN.
Let's return to All Politics is Local in Massachusetts on New England's News and Talk Radio, WCRN. Once again, here's your hosts, John Featherston and Terry Hendricks.
Good Sunday morning. You're tuned to All Politics is Local on WCRN 830. We're joined on the phone by a very special guest. Let me set the table a little bit. That's Terry Hendricks. Good morning. I'm John Featherston, and we're joined on the phone by Raheel Raza, who is a Muslim-Canadian journalist, author and public speaker and media consultant, anti-racism activist, and an interfaith discussion leader. She joins us this morning from Toronto, Canada, and she is the author of the book, Their Jihad is Not My Jihad. I was turned on to Ms. Raza by, believe it or not, Curt Schilling of Boston Red Sox fame. Curt Schilling prompted me to her latest video making the rounds on Facebook and the internet. Good morning, Raheel Raza. Thank you for joining us on All Politics is Local.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, we're very excited to have you on because, like I said, you're the author of the book, Their Jihad, Not My Jihad. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your book?
Well, I am a Pakistani-born Canadian, and I have been working in the field of anti-radicalization and speaking out against terrorists and extremists for the last 25 years. After 9/11, we were very shocked, of course, but not entirely surprised, because many of us who have been watching what has been happening with the rise of radical Islamist ideologies had been warning our governments that this is something that could happen. And so, you know, 9/11 happened, and then there was this knee-jerk reaction about sort of a war of weapons, when we had been consistently saying that this is about ideas. It's an ideology which can't be fought with weapons of mass destruction. It has to be fought, you know, it's a war of ideas. And we, liberal, progressive Muslims, reform-minded Muslims, are the frontline warriors in this war, because if you say anything, you'll be called racist and Islamophobic. So I wrote this book, Their Jihad, Not My Jihad, one to differentiate between the two concepts of jihad, which is an internal struggle for me and for the extremists. It is an armed war. And I also wrote it. It was a collection of my articles and essays that I had been writing for the 5 years before 9/11, warning both the Muslim communities and the leaders of our governments to sort of be a little more vigilant, to wake up and smell the coffee, so to speak, and understand that we are looking at a problem that's going to grow. And of course, 10 years down the line, we see that it has grown. The so-called war against terror hasn't worked, because now you have more terrorists than before. And not only are they out there, but they're right here on North American soil. So, you know, I go back and I read the book, which was, of course, you know, more than 7-8 years ago. And everything I wrote in it and said in it is valid today as well, because nothing much has changed. Just the players have changed. The names have changed. You know, there's all these shifting labels and these shifting personas. But the problem is worse than ever. And so, you know, it's a terrible feeling to have to say, I told you so. But that essentially is what it is.
Absolutely. You know, once again, thank you for joining us. You know, our president, President Obama, he says ISIS is contained and, you know, they're not much of a threat. He actually referred to them as the JV team. What are your comments when you hear something like that? The president of the free world isn't worried about radical Islam.
Well, he has difficulty articulating those two words in the same sentence. And, you know, you can live in denial for a long time. But this is, I think, one of the biggest problems that America faces. It is the two extremes. You know, you have people like Hillary Clinton and President Obama saying that there's no problem and they're, you know, a small number. And then on the other extreme, you have people like Trump saying you should ban all Muslims. Now, neither one of these are balanced facts and, you know, neither one of these are addressing the problem head on. Therefore, the documentary By the Numbers. You know, this was a mind-boggling study. It's a mind-boggling study of human nature, and it is for people like President Obama and Hillary Clinton to see, which I hope they have, to show them that facts and figures don't lie. You know, we, in our struggle against radical Islamist ideology, which is the politicization of my faith, have been saying this, but when you have facts and figures to support your mandates and what you're trying to say, it gives you a very sorry picture of the human race in which, you know, millions of people are ready to accept violence in the name of our faith. So, you know, we ask the question, where is the political will to defeat this ideology? You know, what we can do is make people aware. We are not the policymakers. We are not the presidents. We are not the leaders. But we need to have the as you say, you know, the leader of the free world at least articulate that there is a problem. Because, you know, it's like a disease. If you have a virus, unless you can narrow it down and unless you can isolate that virus and call it what it is, how can you treat it? It's like treating cancer with baby aspirin.
Well, I think the issue is that President Obama really doesn't know how to solve the problem. And it's a problem that I guess it's maybe challenging for him in a lot of ways. Maybe he doesn't want to take the right steps, or more appropriately, he probably doesn't know what the right steps are, and I'm not sure our government really knows. But if it's an ideal, like you say, you know, how do you control it? How do you fix it? Or how do you turn, you know, a population that's so radicalized that all they really want to do is basically kill people? How do you turn that around?
You do turn it around, and there are ways of doing it, and this is why we ask them to reach out to us. I mean, these statistics are there not just to shock people, but to say, yes, there are solutions, but, you know, we need to be able to address the problem before we can talk about the solution. And, you know, we haven't had that discussion. So it's very important to have that discussion. Blaming Islam or defending Islam is not the solution. We have to organize ourselves, you know, with a strategy, and we have to defeat it just like we defeated communism and fascism, and this is no different.
Well, let's say that we could wave a magic wand, and on January 1st, you were Secretary of State of the United States. What would you do?
Well, the first thing I would see is where the messages of hate and where the funding is coming from. So let me retract for a second. People are not born terrorists. They're taught hate, and that's how, that's what makes them violent. So right here in North America, both in America and Canada, there are religious institutions and organizations that are perpetuating this ideology of us and them. And let me tell you that this is not happening in isolation. This comes on the backs of billions of petrodollars, which are being pumped into this ideology through Saudi Arabia and Qatar and other Gulf states. And this money is sitting right here in North America. First thing would be to check where the funding for these organizations is coming from. Second thing would be that those organizations that have sleazy backgrounds, like, you know, CARE, for example, who have been labeled a terrorist organization by the United Arab Emirates and are unindicted co-conspirators in the Texas terrorism trials, why are they allowed to be the spokesperson of the entire Muslim community? So a bit of knowledge, a bit of awareness that the Muslim communities in North America are very diverse, and obviously not all of them are violent terrorists, but there are messages that come from these institutions which need to be stopped, which need to be checked, which need to be surveyed. Why is this being allowed, and why is there so much appeasement of these Islamist organizations? Who are they trying to please? And political correctness has to be thrown out of the window, because we don't have time for political correctness.
I agree with that.
We need to nail the problem. You know, we say, name it, claim it, name it and shame it. And this is what we are doing through this documentary By the Numbers and by our new movement called the Muslim Reform Movement, in which we are not mincing words because we waited a long time for the leaders to sort of take the wheel on this, but they seem to be sleeping at the wheel. So it's now up to us, and we put our necks on the line, we put our lives on the line to do this. But we need support, because this is not an isolated Muslim problem, by the way.
We're joined on the phone by Raheel Raja, leading expert on jihad, and her book, Their Jihad, Not My Jihad. We'll pick up more after the break. You're tuned to All Politics is Local on WCRN, and we'll be back with more right after the break.
You're listening to All Politics is Local in Massachusetts on New England's News and Talk Radio, 830 WCRN. Once again, here's your hosts, John Featherston and Terry Hendricks.
Good Sunday morning. You're tuned to All Politics is Local here on WCRN 830. That's Terry Hendricks. I'm John Featherston on this last Sunday morning of 2015. We're joined on the phone from Toronto, Canada this morning. A very special guest. Good morning, Raheel Raja.
Good morning.
Thank you again. And we're going to pick it back up on the conversation and your book, Their Jihad, Not My Jihad. I want to get right into it because, you know, I'm a father of two teenage boys. Means the world to me. I wake up every day over the holiday season and I go, okay, good, there wasn't another terrorist attack today. I always look at it as it's just a matter of time. It's not if it's going to happen, it's going to be when it's going to happen. You must have those same fears living in Canada. What is the government going to do? I mean, my words, President Obama does not want to address this issue. I'm not saying that he supports it, but I don't think he has the political courage to take this on. I also don't agree with Donald Trump that, you know, you got to keep every Muslim out. What do we do?
Well, we walk the balanced path. And as you said, you made me head of state for a little while in the last conversation. what I would do is make sure that everyone is aware of the balanced issues. See, people are not getting the right information because there's so much pussyfooting around the word terrorism and Islamist. So let me put it out there for you. It's very clear. There is a problem within the Muslim world of a rise of violence in the name of our faith. This is a mutated version of the faith. This is not the spiritual message that I follow. But obviously, all according even to this Pew poll that this film was based on, all Muslims are not radicalized. But there's no way to deny that there is a significant and serious problem of radicalization in the Muslim world. So we have to address it. We have to talk about it. I mean, America is a country where all decisions are made around round tables. You think that they can't sit around and discuss what they can do about this? They obviously don't have the political will to do it. I mean, look at the relationship with Saudi Arabia, for example. It impinges on oil. So who's going to say boo to them when they are the main culprits in this? And nobody, no leader articulates this. So this is the important thing. First of all, you have to, narrow down the problem, and then we can start talking about the solutions. Our youth are being radicalized. They're going out there to fight ISIS. Who is radicalizing them in America? Obviously, it's being done through some local institutions. I know the internet plays a role, but there are also messages of hate, of us and them, of differences coming in. So we need to change the narrative.
Well,
Muslims can't do it alone.
When you wake up in the morning and hear overnight news that, we bombed, an ISIS camp and nobody in this country knows where it is. It sounds good. It looks good on television. But it doesn't fix the problem. I think it's marketing. Hey, we're bombing the hell out of them.
Yes,
well, great. How do we know anybody's even in that cave? How do we even know that I'm not saying it's staged.
Yes, but as I said, that's not a solution. It is a, you can bomb them to smithereens, more will pop up. You know, it's like that game where you keep hitting the heads of these, you know, things that pop up, and you hit one and five other pop up. And this is what will keep on happening. And they will keep on attacking the West because they themselves have declared a war on the West. You know, this is not my word. This is their word. They have said, we hate the West. The West is evil, and we're going to attack them every which way we can. So, yes, when I wake up in the morning and I hear of something happening, I'm thinking this is not solving the problem. So these attacks within North America are going to continue until we can really narrow down on what is happening within the Muslim world. And that is for the Muslims to do. So we are standing up to bring about that change. You know, we are asking the mosques to get rid of the narrative of armed jihad. So one of the problems that the Islamic State and what it wants to spread is that they want to live in 7th century Arabia, which means that some of the concepts that existed at that time, they want to make them active and alive now. We are saying that that was for the 7th century. We need to bring Islam into the modern world. And in order to do that, we have to denounce the idea of armed jihad, the idea that, you know, we are not living in tribes anymore. We have nation states. We have to learn to respect each other. We have to learn to get along. We have to learn to, gender equality is important. So all this ties in with an ideology, a mindset. Now, of course, you're looking at countries like Pakistan or Bangladesh or, you know, the third world countries where a large population is uneducated and the masses are illiterate, and they become fodder for the people who want to manipulate their minds, the mercenaries who go and prey on them, buy their soul, so to speak. So all this has to be taken into consideration. There needs to be enlightenment and education. And one of our mandates is to expose the problem, to educate the masses, and then eradicate the problem. But according to your president, we can't even expose the problem yet. So how on earth are we going to talk about it? At least in Canada, we were able to make some changes in the laws, the immigration laws. We have a bill that was passed. We gave testimony to the Senate. And so we have an anti-terrorism bill. We have a new law about, no violence against women. So, you know, the government does have our ear somewhat. But, I wish there was something I could say to the American leaders to say that, you know, knee-jerk reactions, bigotry, hatred, stopping immigration is not the solution. If we are going to find a solution, we have to work together. There's just no other option. You don't have to like us, but we have to work together.
We do. We have to work together.
Well, I have worked with Muslims and in various ways. I have a good friend of mine who's originally from Iran, and he and I had a conversation over a couple of holiday libations recently, and he basically came here to college in the mid-70s, and he was graduating from college in 1979, and his parents basically said, you know, don't come home. Don't come back to Iran right now. And of course, you know what was going on in Iran at the time, and he's been back a couple times, but he goes back and he's concerned that he may not be able to come back to the United States, and he's a citizen and we had an interesting conversation, and I said, well, you know, how does the Iranian people feel about America? And he says 90% of them love America, love the culture, love the people. And he says, but it's that 10% that really run the country and have basically their politics around hate and us and them. And I've worked with, Muslims and non-Muslims. And I guess the terrorist, the jihadist, I haven't found it. I've dealt with, Muslims in business. And I guess I've either been fortunate or not noticed, but generally found, you know, people that were very nice, generally educated, nice to have a conversation with them.
Well, absolutely, and that is something that I think everyone should remember. However, along with that, we must also remember that much of this ideology that is being perpetuated is coming from, you know, either the Muslim Brotherhood standpoint or in terms of Iran and the Shias, it's coming from this Khomeiniist agenda, none of which is conducive to live and let live, and none of which is in support of the West. So if there are ideas or any kind of rhetoric that is against the West, and you're living right here, and these kids are being taught that the West is evil and they're not your friend. So, you know, you have to think about where this is coming from and how we can stop that rhetoric and start a new conversation. You know, this is our home. I mean, I came as an immigrant here, you know, 25 years ago, but my children are loyal to the land in which they live, and so are we. This is home, and you never want to harm a place that you call home. So we have to totally change the conversation. We have to change the narrative. And I'm not saying this is going to happen overnight, but let's look at our brothers and sisters in the Christian faith. How long was the reform, and how difficult, and how bloody, and, you know, we have to look at that and say, yes, there can be change within religion, and we have to have separation of mosque and state. We have to denounce some of these notions of armed jihad, because slavery existed in the 7th century. We no longer accept that. So other things have to change as well. We need total gender equality. We need respect for people of all faiths. And together, we can start talking about change. But somehow, some way, we have to convince our leaders that they need to be part of the conversation, or rather they need to bring us into the conversation. If they don't want to articulate the problem, we will do it for them.
We're joined on the phone by Rahil Raja, calling in this morning from Toronto, Canada. She is the author of the book, Their Jihad, Not My Jihad. Rahil, I hope we can hold you over into the next break, because there's a couple issues that I think we need to get in to talk about, and one of them being care, and I think it's important that we have that conversation with our audience as well. But I also want to talk real quick a bit about the video that is getting such wide play on the on Facebook and on the internet right now, and the Muslim Reform Movement, your Facebook page as well. We have just a couple minutes before the top of the hour break, but I hope we can hold you over. But why don't you talk to us a little bit about your Muslim Reform Movement and on Facebook and how you're getting the message out?
Yes, sure. Yeah, the Muslim Reform Movement was actually launched, unfortunately, the day that the San Bernardino terrorist attacks took place. So we were in Washington, and this was a collection of reform-minded Muslims from all over the world. And we came together to say this is the tipping point. It's no longer valid just to say words, because we've been doing this. I mean, you know, we've been writing, speaking for the last 20 years, but doesn't seem to have reached the right ears. What we need to do is take action. So we launched this declaration. It's on the Muslim Reform Movement Facebook page. And the first thing we did after our press conference at the National Press Club in Washington is we took that declaration and posted it on the door of the Saudi-funded mosque in Washington, D.C.
Really?
In a very Martin Luther-esque way, yes. And we have, demands that we would like to put forward to the religious institutions. And, you mentioned care. We'd like to give this to them and say, you know, yes or no.
Well, we're gonna pick up on that conversation after the top of the hour break. You're listening to All Politics is Local on WCRN, and we'll be back.